Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Orville Universe Podcast. Today we are talking about Alara and the decisions she has to make, whether humans belong in zoos, and if Kermit would have been a good starship captain.
All that right after this.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Orville Universe Podcast. My name is Matthew Carroll.
I'm Matthew Westfox.
What's happening, Matthew?
Not too much. Glad to be, we've both been traveling some, so glad to be back and getting to talk about this great show.
Yeah, man. You've been all over the place, right?
I have been, yeah. I was going up and down the East Coast doing Magic the Gathering stuff. My geekdom is takes on many, many varieties, so I'm a judge for Magic the Gathering, so I was going to a couple events for that. And now finally back home.
That is super rad. I love Magic the Gathering, but I'm one of those fans that like gets into it once every 15 years or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Or once every 10 years. I keep having these sort of relapses and like get real into it for a few months and then not play for 10 years, then get real into it for 3 months.
I hear you. Yeah, for me, it's funny because I love the game, and this is going to be relevant to some of the stuff we're going to talk about in a bit because of community. What has really kept me in is becoming a judge and becoming part of the Magic community because of that. Because it was, when I really needed a group of friends to kind of be a part of and to be part of this national thing, Magic was just a great place for that.
Yeah, that's rad. I'm sort of jealous of your sticking with it and getting that deep into it, because I can absolutely see that being really fun. What did you think of this episode? Episode 2 of the Orville.
I liked it. I think this was the episode where I really understood, okay, this is a Star Trek love letter, first and foremost. And I think that was why... It's funny. The first time I watched this episode, my partner and I had been watching Star Trek Discovery. And I think in a lot of ways, if I go back and watch Discovery again, I will enjoy it a lot more. The first time I saw it, though, I was very disappointed because, and I know this is a whole other topic, to me, Discovery didn't feel like Star Trek, at least not in the way that I was wanting when I heard a new Star Trek show was coming. And I got told by a bunch of people, if you're really hankering for Star Trek, watch The Orville. And as we've talked about before, I was nervous about it. I think this was the episode where I really was like, okay, not only is this an homage to Star Trek, we are doing Star Trek things. Because especially the whole element of... We're going to jump right in with spoilers, by the way, for this is for episode 2. But spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't thought of that before. You know, one of the things that I love, especially about original Star Trek, is that sometimes they would basically create a fairly ham-handed way of saying, let's look at a foreign culture that replicates an issue from our own. And so when I realized that our two main characters were stuck in a world where they were now in a zoo, and it was having to raise all these questions about zoos themselves and who gets to decide, you know, who is a higher form of life or any of that kind of stuff, and having animals kept for the amusement of other animals... It was both the exact kind of question that Star Trek would raise, and I say this with affection, it was done in exactly the same kind of ham-fisted, over-the-top way that Star Trek would do. That I was just like, okay, you know what? This is exactly what I wanted. This is Star Trek all over again. I am here for it. I love this episode for that reason.
Yeah, I definitely liked that. I felt like this episode actually is not my favorite episode. Because of a few things that I do feel like they had potential, and then it kind of like it's called command performance. Is that right?
Yep.
There's two major things happening. There's the zoo stuff, and I feel like they don't fully flesh it out because in the end they don't set free the zoo, which I feel like would have been. And this goes along with something I like about the show is that it. They don't always win.
Right.
Sometimes they lose. But in this, they didn't make it feel like a loss. I kind of felt like maybe they should have paid some homage to the fact that they're leaving behind so many people.
Right. They rescue the one cute young one.
Right.
But there's a sort of lesson there about, like, well, if you're cute, you're willing to be rescued, but everyone else, not so much.
Yeah, like, couldn't they have, I don't know, maybe they probably couldn't have, but I guess I would have liked them to say, we can't do it, and it's a sad thing that we can't do it, that we're leaving all of these people in a zoo. And it almost feels like two different episodes. You have that, and then you have the sort of trial of young Alara in her first time with command, and it's a big trial. Like, she has to decide to go against the Admiralty and, like, go to save her people, and that I felt like was left as well, sort of lacking in consequences, or a serious. It didn't treat it with enough seriousness in my mind. It almost felt like Alara chose to do the thing she did, chose to go get her people because she was peer pressured into it. Almost.
So we're going to – I know one of the things we're going to talk about is Alara's decision, and that's I'm definitely with you on that. I was wondering if we were going to have a disagreement here because I think Alara was dead wrong. And I thought the way the show phrased it was really kind of broken in ways I disagreed with. I think I guess maybe it's that I – because everything you're saying I'm totally agreeing with. I did think that – having the zoo be the B plot and Alara clearly be the A plot, I didn't mind once I realized that's what they were doing because it seemed like a way of saying this whole zoo thing is completely a contrivance and it's really kind of a nod to the Star Trek, but that's not what we're really trying to do with this episode. And so I think I liked that more, but you're right. It meant that it didn't get developed enough. And on some level, it meant that while on the one hand it seemed they were saying these people who run the zoo are morally terrible, they also, you're right, there was no consequence for them, there was no challenge to it. At the end of the day, it was, as long as our people get out of the zoo, who cares about the rest?
It's like they actually came up with a pretty good plan, which a few parts of – did they mention how they got the holographic technology to cover the ship to look like a – different ship? Because I don't think we ever see that technology again. And I was wondering if it came from the other ship that was doing that, which would have been a nice, like, problem-solving thing. Like, hey, we scavenged this technology off this exploded ship and skinned ourselves, and then we're going to use the Kalon as the equal to the zoo people. I forget their names.
I think that's what it was. I think it was something technologically related to that other ship, but that may have also been a hand wave.
Yeah, I don't even remember mentioning it. I just rewatched it. And I was like kind of looking for it, but I may have missed it. But I kind of wish what I would have wished for a proper choice, Alara should either face consequences at the end of this episode, maybe demotion, whatever. Something should happen to her. Instead, they give her these like Scarlet Star or something like that, or the Crimson Star. That's what they called it. which just felt like you disobeyed direct order. Like, you shouldn't be getting a medal. And it's not like she should have, at least, at a minimum, in my mind, she should have called the Admiralty back and been like, hey, I know you said not to question your order, but we've put together a plan involving this holographic technology and this Kalon that we have, these two resources that you may not have known we had. And now we have a chance. There's a chance we can go save them, and we're willing to risk our lives to do it. And then if the Admiralty still says no, then she still has a decision to make. But I wish they had like just fully had that conversation. Instead, she just kind of lets them peer pressure her into doing what's against the Admiral's plan. I don't know.
Well, so let's jump into that, because I think that is clearly the moral sort of heart of this episode, and I think it's a good place for us to talk. Because I want to start just from the Admiralty's decision. It is and I admit to some extent this is a gripe I have with almost all stories of this type. You know, this comes up in Captain America. It comes up in all sorts of war movies and science fiction and space battle movies. But there's always this idea that the overlords, the generals, will say that because of some larger strategic reason, we can't go in and rescue this one or two people or a small group of people. And our heroes will almost always say, no, that's ridiculous. You know, forget about all the strategic consequences. That's all meaningless. We have to go and rescue our people. And some of the times the show or the movie sets that up in a way that I can go along with it. But I have to admit, an awful lot of the time, I am left thinking, I want you to rescue those two people, and especially because they're main characters, of course I want you to rescue them. But if you ask me, is it worth risking a war that millions could die in, or, you know, losing a war because of a horrible strategy thing that will happen, or whatever the conceit is.
Or even just risking the ship. Just risking all of those, you know, the hundreds of lives on the ship.
Right. Even that alone, which they are clearly doing. So even before we get into all the stuff about how she makes the decision, which I agree with you is 100% peer pressure, I have to say, I get for storytelling reasons why it wasn't going to be that way, but I was kind of on the side of the Admiralty.
Yeah, me too. Unfortunately, me too. And I feel like maybe if they had had... Like, maybe you could have this conversation where you convince yourself the Admiralty is wrong. Maybe it's a tenet of the Union that they never leave a man behind, similar to some of our, you know, our current day military.
Right.
You never leave a man behind. And there is a certain logic to that. If you never leave a man behind, then your soldiers know that every individual soldier can trust that in the time that you're in need, your entire military will marshal itself to save that one person. So it creates a camaraderie and a trust that they could have had that conversation. And I think this episode kind of having these two sort of thin points that sort of hurt it, in my opinion. I think it's a side effect of the fact that they didn't really have this show figured out yet. I don't think these kinds of bald problems happen very often on the Orville. And they kind of do in the first episode, feels kind of thin, and the second episode feels kind of thin. For me, you mentioned this being the episode that you were like, this is Trek. To me, it's the next episode, which we won't get into, but I'm sure we'll talk about it like next week. But, you see in the stinger of this episode is that the Mocklin baby is female, which is not supposed to be possible. And that creates a whole episode which we're about to get to. And that's the episode that I was like, oh my gosh, they're asking like hard questions. They're like actually asking hard questions. And I think that episode mostly sticks on one A plot and it's about a thing.
Yeah, well, and I should say, just to kind of clarify, I think you're right. I think the next episode is this show being Trek at its best. I think this episode was it being Trek at its worst.
Totally.
But that's what I have an affection for bad Star Trek episodes.
Oh, me too.
And that's what I kind of meant about the ham-fisted thing. It's like there are some Star Trek episodes where I'm like, okay, I see what you're trying to do. I think you did it in a dumb way, and I pretty much disagree with your characters anyway, but I love that you're trying to do it.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like watching maybe your kid at Little League, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's what I mean about falling in love with the show through this episode, because everything you're saying, you're right. In many ways, to me, this is a great episode. It's not a good episode, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, totally. And the thing is, and you mentioned ham-fisted, not to get too much into next week, but I think the next episode is very ham-fisted as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very much like we're going to cover a topic and we are going to, like you said, put some sort of alien situation that very much mirrors situations that we face today. And we're going to have it be very obvious what we're talking about.
Right.
But next week does it in a more artful way, I think. I think next week is still that same sort of ham-fisted Star Trek kind of story allegory.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done really well. Anyway, I keep jumping forward because I really like next week is an episode I was really looking forward to. I actually thought that was the second episode. So when I watched this one, I was like, oh, I completely forgot this episode existed.
Yeah. I think I did the same because I thought of the first one as the pilot. I think the pilot came out a little bit before, and then it was like we hit the ground with the first episode, second episode, but
right.
I'm not sure there. But either way, so let's. I think we're kind of both in agreement that, you know, maybe. And again, because you can just discuss how much this is a military versus a science group and things like that. But even getting beyond that, so let's now talk about how Alara makes the decision, because on the one hand, I feel like what they are going for is that Alara is wrestling with having to make the hard decisions that command comes with, and having to, that there's an element of command is being willing to say, you know, the buck stops with me, I can make this decision even if everyone disagrees with me. And I get that, and I think there's a worthiness there. But you're right, instead it becomes about peer pressure. It becomes about her, to some extent, I feel like at the start, she is doing exactly what command says she should do. She's making the hard decision, she's looking at the larger picture, she's looking at things beyond just the emotional reaction that the crew is having, and she's willing to have the crew be angry at her about that. And so then to see her just go completely against that and go, well, they won't let me sit with the cool kids at lunch anymore, so I'm going to go put us all in danger so I can have lunch with them again, that just seems so weak.
Yeah, I think they were trying a little bit, because the actual conversation that changes her mind is a conversation with Malloy, where he says, the truth is, if you had been the one in trouble, he would have gone to get you. Which is a valid point, and like that is actually a conversation that she could have had with almost any character, and it would have been, it could have been the pivoting point for that storyline.
Yep.
But the problem is, I think, in the character that it comes from, because if Claire had had that conversation with her after being sort of on board with, yes, the Admiralty is making the right decision, but the truth is he would make a different one. Because he cares about his crew, and that's also part of command. That could have worked. But Malloy, up till this point, has just been a brat about the whole thing and been completely unsupportive. And, like you said, pushing her away from the lunch table. So I thought, coming from his character, it just felt like peer pressure instead of a wise friend coming to her with like a real with real wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, if one of the others, if the doctor or someone else, you know, Yaphet even, had said it in that kind of a way, where it's like, hey, here's just something I want you to think about. But from Malloy, it's very sneering. It's very like, here's one more way that you're terrible.
Yeah, it is.
And I also have to ask, and granted, we have, at this point, it's only the second episode, so we've not seen much of the captain. But what we have seen of the captain is that he is, and I like this, that he's not super alpha male, but that he is fairly indecisive and fairly tentative and fairly worried about bucking the trend.
Hmm.
Have we seen anything to indicate that he would have gone to get her?
No. The answer is no. The only situation we've seen, and who knows, there could have been a few adventures we missed. You know, there's always that possibility. But they haven't – while it – in some ways, I think this episode does a really good job of establishing some character things, because we do get who Malloy is, we get who Claire is, we get who even the two that are stuck in the zoo, the captain and his first officer, we kind of get a sense more of who they are. And I think that's what this episode is really what it's trying to establish. But it also makes some leaps, like that one, where you're like, wait, would he? Do you guys know that? Because why does Claire know that? We just, as far as we know, we just met... we just met him at the same time she did, and haven't. We don't know that they've had 16 other adventures between now and then that taught her who he is as a captain.
Right.
Or I'm sorry, it's Malloy that says that. So you know, though, I will say we don't know that, but the person who says that is Malloy. Now that I was thinking it was Claire for some reason, maybe I rewrote it in my head because I liked it more if it was Claire. But actually, now that I think about it, it makes sense that it was Malloy, because Malloy is one of the few people on the ship who does know that about the captain.
And I get that, and then I think it just would have been nice if Malloy had said something like, because if the idea is that, if the headcanon is that Malloy knows this for things that Alara, and then therefore also the audience, doesn't know, that could make sense, but then I wish he had said it in something like, you know, you haven't seen this side of him yet, but he would absolutely go get it. You know, something to kind of indicate that, like, Malloy is presenting us with new information. Because,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, if that had been said in season three, I think all of us just look at it and go, well, of course, yeah, we know that about the captain. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we just don't know that about him yet.
Well, if we're going to do a rewrite, here's my rewrite. Because I love to do that. Instead of going into a full dining room, she goes into that room and she says, give me a hit of Zalean tequila, double shot. And then she looks down the bar and it's just her and Malloy sitting there and he's drunk. And he tells her a story of a time that the captain did this for his people. Or like when he was a first officer on the da-da-da, he went above and beyond to save this person. And I just, it hurts me so much to find, like, it maybe have a moment of true connection instead of just like sort of catty, sort of like, you know, whatever, like that sort of mean girl thing they're doing.
Yeah.
Instead of that, have them have a moment of connection where he says, this is who the captain is. You don't know this yet, but this is who the captain is. And he would absolutely do this for you. And then have that change her mind and also show the humanity in Malloy that he's not just being mean to her and not that he just wants to save his friend because it's his friend, but like he actually believes in the captain. And I don't know, there would have been a better way to do that.
I would have loved to see that. And I think what I would have loved to see is if they had taken a shuttle, you know, or if there had been some other way where it had been Isaac and Alara and maybe one other. But they hadn't put the whole ship at, you know, that what she had said was, you know, I'm obeying the order. The Orville is not going anywhere near, but they didn't order me what to do with this shuttle that we just captured from the other ship. You know, like that, that some way of, because then she still puts her, she's putting herself at risk, but she's also still honoring the fact of that that as important as those two people are, that they maybe shouldn't put everybody else at risk.
Right. And that the chain of command is actually important. Like, this thing that we're all here to do, the whole, like, military-style governing is important, and there's a reason we do it, and it's because, like, making decisions by committee can be better at making – when you're making such decisions when, like, all these lives are at stake.
Yeah. And I think I agree with you. I think the more I think about it, I think what you said about them not really knowing what the show was going to be yet, because it – and this, in some ways, it just kind of ties in more to what I was saying about Star Trek. It feels like Seth MacFarlane was on some level being like, okay, I want a what just happens in Star Trek? They do moral issues. Okay, let's do a zoo issue. But they didn't really have the thought that some of these later episodes had.
Yeah.
You know, it was Star Trek on the surface, whereas the next episode we're going to get into is really where it hits the heart and soul of what made Star Trek so good.
Well, they're doing what all Star Trek series have done. Start out not knowing what they're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, that first season of TNG is bad. The first season of DS9 is bad. You know, all the seasons of Voyager are bad. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Hey, listen, I am a ride hard or die for Voyager. I'm sure this will come out. I love Voyager. I think Voyager is a very good show. I refuse to accept that my love of Voyager has anything to do with the fact that I watched most of it after having major surgery and thus was high on painkillers.
I won't ever ask you to rewatch it then. I don't want to take that joy away from you, but I must admit I really hate Voyager.
There are parts of it that are very bad, I will completely admit.
I don't know if we've gotten into we probably got into it on the first episode, so I don't want to dive in too deep. But yeah, I just don't. It just, it goes nowhere. That's my whole thing. That's my three word thing. The characters do not change.
And that's fair.
And that's my biggest problem. And TNG does the same thing, but it's like a different time. After DS9, when the characters changed so much, I had a hunger for better Trek. And to me, they just don't change. The characters don't change.
Yeah, I mean, I think, let's not get too far into the tangent
I want to go into it.
No. Well, I mean, I'm going to say let's not go into the tangent as I respond. but I think the thing with Trek is, and this is relevant to what we're saying, because it's relevant to what is the Trek that we keep comparing Orville to. I think today people forget how much DS9 is the outlier in terms of Star Trek. Like, it's considered by many to be the best Star Trek, and I think there's a strong argument to be made for that, though I'm not quite sure it's my favorite Star Trek. And certainly now with Discovery and probably with the Picard show, DS9 is becoming more the definition of what Star Trek is going forward. But at the time, it was radically different than anything Star Trek had ever been. And you know, all the other Star Trek shows have much more in common with each other than they do with DS9.
Yes, that is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. And to me, DS9 was just like the culmination of Star Trek. I mean, it's what it led to. And I think it's borne out over time. I just watched it. I don't know if you had a chance to see it. What We Left Behind, they just put out a Star Trek DS9 documentary. And it just was in theaters. It was in, it was one of those in theaters for one day kind of things.
Yeah.
We talked about it over on the Star Trek Universe podcast, and it's great. It's really interesting, but that's a lot of what they got. Kept getting pushback. The studio kept telling them, like, no, it's got to be episodic. Like, every episode has to be a new story. You can't just keep. And finally, the studio just, like, let them do what they did. But they, the whole time, the studio just kept pushing back. And even the people, they had interviews with the people who were those studio heads pushing back. And they were like, yeah, it was a different time in TV. And, like, obviously now that's not how TV is made. And so they were very forward thinking in what they did. But at the time, we just needed them to make episodic television because that's what, how people watch television at that point, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's very true. And I think I'll admit part of why I'm probably not as in love with DS9 as many other people were is that my ride or die show for a long time was Babylon 5, which. And there's all the debates about which came first and to what extent DS9 is or is not a ripoff of Babylon 5. But because of that, I always had a kind of – there's a sort of Jetson Sharks. Like, I can't like DS9 quite as much. And that's I finally watched all of it and loved it. But that's just my own thing.
I hear you guys talk about Babylon 5 all the time and on Superhero Ethics. And I've wanted to go and watch it, but I still haven't had time.
It's a show. It is in many ways, I think, the best science fiction television I've ever seen, and it's also so horribly cheesy and bad in some ways. So,
yeah.
But I was gonna say, in terms of two characters develop, there's a relationship between two of the main characters that just the way the character growth that it has over five seasons, I've never seen in any other TV show.
That's neat. I look forward to it. I look forward to it. So back to the Orville. A couple of moments I really liked. For one thing, I hate that I can't remember the name of the creatures that had the zoo, the aliens that had the zoo. But I really liked that the humans aren't the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And we got that with Kalon, but it was more of a joke in the first episode. But I like that there are species out in the universe that are just smarter and more advanced than humans, and they're not... We're not, I don't know, I feel like in Star Trek, we're generally, humans are just kind of they're at least in the argument for, like, just sort of the head species.
Right.
It's always them and a couple other species that are sort of, like, running the galaxy, and I kind of wish, I kind of like how in this, we're out there, we're the Union, but we're not necessarily the best or smartest or even what a superior in any way. I thought that was kind of cool, like kind of a cool twist on the Star Trek universe sort of idea. I liked when Bordis brings up the egg, and it's a surprise, but he doesn't sort of, he makes jokes about it definitely, and sort of like picks on himself for those jokes. He says, "I'm not going to try humor with you anymore." That was one of my favorite jokes.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment, because we've talked about the, like, is there too much Seth MacFarlane humor there? And this seemed like a transitional moment, because it was like, he's going to get in the Seth MacFarlane joke about this, but he's also then going to make fun of himself for doing it.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that him making fun of his own jokes was a key moment in the sort of the humor of this show. And just, I liked that it was a surprise, but there wasn't any sort of like judgment or you're weird. I liked the cultural sensitivity sort of. Even
right.
though he made jokes, there was still a cultural sensitivity there that I liked. One of my favorite jokes in the episode was when Claire has all this wisdom, the doctor has all this wisdom throughout the episode, and then she's left in command and she says, "Son of a bitch."
Yeah.
That's great.
I think one of my favorite moments, and it establishes something this show does that is ridiculous and dumb, but they make no apologies for it, which I really kind of love. Him having Kermit on his desk.
Oh, yep. And that was the next one, yeah.
Well, and here's the way I feel about that, because first of all, I am a huge Muppets fan. I adore the Muppets, and I loved hearing the sort of description of Kermit as a leader and how he was successful, especially because Kermit, like our captain, is a very anxiety-ridden guy, and I like how they're portraying that. So that was great.
It gave me a framework to think about the captain. I'm like, oh, he really, like, I think about him, and I'm like, he really is a Kermit. Like, that's his, he makes
right.
jokes, he's funny, he cares about his people. Like, the Muppets, this show is actually similar, more similar to the Muppets in some ways than to Star Trek in the sort of tone that it strikes, where it's a comedy, but the Muppets always were they always did have a story they were telling, and they're trying to
accomplish a
mission.
Oh, there's a lot of depth there, for sure.
Yeah, and so that gave me kind of an idea of what they're trying to do with the Orville, and I loved the Kermit. As he's a great leader that I admire.
Well, and part of what I also like about it is, and this is something I think Star Trek never did, is it reminds you that even though these people are people in a military space environment, they're still people who enjoy pop culture, or in this case, very much old culture, and you know, that they're the kind of people who would have, like, random toys from things that they love in their offices. And that was something Star Trek never did, and I really appreciated that here. The other thing that is, it sets up that has been, it was at first something that drove me a little crazy about the show until I just decided to just accept it and love it, and it was wonderful, is they established this idea that for some reason, the main culture that all of these people are constantly going to be making reference to is the culture of present day and of the last 20 or 30 years, like present day to us today.
Yeah.
And on the one, like, Star Trek always tried to sort of, you know, throw in cultural references to that fun baseball player from the 22nd century.
Or the Klingon opera.
Yeah, or things like that. And it was, I liked what they tried to do with the world building, but it also felt very forced. And I kind of appreciate that here the show is just like, no, fuck it. Our audience knows about the culture of the late 20th, earliest 21st century. And so for some reason we will never explain, everyone in the Orville universe is completely obsessed with that time. It kind of reminds me almost of Ready Player One, and how, like, in Ready Player One, they establish that for these weird reasons that have happened, everyone in the time is just obsessed with the 80s.
Yeah.
And so they're just like, okay, for some reason, we're going to have lots of references to the things the audience gets, and let's just go with it.
You just have to kind of accept that as a conceit. Mm-hmm. And I think there's sort of precedent for this in that with the rise of the internet, like in our current day, the rise of the internet, it is way harder to create lasting pop culture because there's so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
That it is very hard to break through the noise because there's just, you know, we're sitting here making a podcast. There are people that are going to listen to our podcast, and this is what they're deciding to listen to today. And we're just two guys in, you know, making a thing we like to make.
Right.
But that's a choice. That's the same choice. It's sitting there on the same app. They'll be looking at Spotify and go, I'm going to listen to these two guys that maybe, you know, maybe 100 other people listen to this, but I'm going to listen to it. And then you could go listen to Taylor Swift, who's like the biggest star in the world. But there's so many options, and it's all kind of on this equal footing on the internet that there mm-hmm. is a case to be made that it's possible that we won't have as many huge pop cultural moments after now.
Yeah.
My favorite things is like to think about, and it's depressing to me. It's actually really hard to become famous now. And if you think about it, most of the people that are famous now are the same people that were famous before the internet existed.
See, I will say I have no idea who is famous now, but I thought that's just because I'm a grumpy old man.
Same here.
Possible as well.
Same here. But we're in a transitional time now. It's starting to be like there's a few younger folks showing up on the scene. Obviously, obviously there's some teenagers that are getting some clout, but it's really hard to do now in a different way than it was hard to do back then.
Well, certainly I feel like, and this is actually it's a good topic that we're going to hit on because one of my favorite Orville episodes is the episode that really goes into social media culture, which we'll get to. I think it's like episode 7 or 8. But it allows me actually to tell kind of a cool Orville-related story because I think that where fame really happens these days is it happens in – to become like the kind of famous that three people from three different social groups all know about, like a Taylor Swift, that's very rare. It can happen, but it's very rare.
Right.
But instead what you can have is the people who are super famous in their small ponds, you know? Like, you talked about, you know, podcasts. If you're into this kind of thing, like, there are people who are really into podcasts like Adventure Zone or My Brother and Me, which are all about, you know, kind of... And if you're into those kind of geeky worlds, then everyone knows exactly who those people are.
Right.
Otherwise, you have no idea, you know?
Well, see, and that's my point is, like, when you get to the level of 200 years from now, even though the McElroys have a huge following now, is anyone going to remember who the McElroys were in 200 years? Not to pick on the McElroys. Because maybe, but it'll be like just that specific group that liked them. Is it likely that they will pass that love on to their children? Probably not. It's going to be really hard to translate. It's so culturally specific in the way that, like, I mean, and you look 200 years back, there's not that many persisted anyway, but it's hard to think that, like, even the biggest stuff today, like the Taylor Swift that is so culturally specific, is going to persist 200 years from now, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, to tying it back again to the Orville, I suppose there's a possibility that Seth MacFarlane was thinking about this and was trying to make some larger point about how culture today is all transcendent and ephemeral, and that the culture of the 90s and the 2000s will survive. I don't think so. I think we're headcanoning that pretty hard at this point.
Yeah, you're probably right. But Star Trek does the same thing to some degree. And well, you mentioned that, that even recently on Discovery, they had an episode where they had a party and they were listening to like 90s hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, all right. I feel like it would have been better if the DJ had played like a song before that and it was just some weird thing that,
right,
you know, we couldn't understand.
The music from Yavetz culture or something like that.
Exactly. How do they even play guitar?
I will say one more just cool thing related to this show about those things. As I mentioned at the start of the show, I spent a lot of time in the Magic the Gathering world, which is another world where you get, like, you know, Tempest in a Teapot, like celebrities who are huge in that world and no one else has ever heard of. And one of the really cool emerging areas with that is in cosplay, the people who dress up in costume to represent things from, you know, different media, and in this case, Magic the Gathering. At one of those gatherings, I met somebody who was both a very talented Magic the Gathering cosplayer, but also is a very big Orville fan and has done some Orville cosplay. And I just thought that was kind of an awesome thing to throw out. I know when you and I started this show, part of what we were thinking of is wondering, like, how much has Orville kind of penetrated into the other parts of geekdom culture? And we talked about how there aren't, you can't really get Orville toys and stuff like that. And I just thought, knowing that there is actually I should have realized, of course there was, but knowing that there's an emerging Orville cosplay community, that just made me so happy about the future of the show.
Yeah, I almost ordered an Orville uniform recently. And I think it was a third-party, like, designer. Like, it wasn't officially licensed, which sucks. Like, get on it, Fox. Like, make some Orville merchandise. We will buy it. And, yeah. I feel like they should have learned this lesson. There was an article a while back about Firefly. Are you a Firefly fan?
Oh, yeah, huge.
Me too. There was an article about one of the reasons we can't get any more Firefly is because Fox won't make it because it's too expensive. But Fox won't let the rights go because the merchandising is so good. Like, they still sell merchandising today for a show they made 20 years ago, and they still it still sells really well. And so it's funny because of our love of that show, we all buy things, and it's actually preventing more of it from being made.
I mean, and now it's way too late, but, like, you know, because all those actors have gone off and done other things. But, you know, if 15 years ago someone had said, like, all of us stop buying so someone else can make this show, that would have been fantastic.
Yeah, but then you just never know, because one of the reasons that show became so big is because it was early days of DVDs, like TV on DVD, like they did TV DVD box sets, and the DVDs sold like crazy. After the show had been canceled, the DVDs sold like crazy, and that's how most people watched it originally. And then, of course, on streaming later. But yeah, like, it's hard to know, because would that show even exist if the merchandising hadn't worked so well? Or would people still know about it? Would people still care if they hadn't sold so much? But then at some point, we were buying so much of it that they would not give up the rights. I still think there's possibility of making more of that show, or at least of that universe. Like, and those actors could come back as themselves older in another form, kind of like a Next Generation, you know?
Yeah, I would love to see that. I think Nathan Fillion alone has become such a big actor that I feel like getting him under contract would be so expensive, but it's always a possibility.
He still says he loves it and would love to do it, but yeah, he does these sort of shows that are, I'm sure they pay well, but they're just not as beloved, you know?
So, and we've talked before about how Seth MacFarlane had to work hard to establish the brand of the show to get people to start watching, and that later he could kind of go off on flights of fancy because people were already committed. You and I are going to have some great tangents on the show. I think episode 2 is not the time, so we should probably wrap this up.
You're right. I'm like, well, we're at the end. Like, if people are annoyed by the tangents, they can...
Let's just sign off.
But yeah, you're right. Let's just sign off. We could have these conversations off air. All right, guys. Thanks for hanging out. We are the Orville Universe Podcast. We'll hope to talk to y'all online and such. Peace.
And remember, friends, in space, everyone is in somebody else's zoo.
Thanks for listening to the Orville Universe Podcast. If you'd like to hear more from Matthew Westfox, search your podcatcher now for the Superhero Ethics Podcast. If you'd like to hear more from me, Matthew Carroll, search your podcatcher for the Marvel Cinematic Universe Podcast and the Star Trek Universe Podcast. Or you can check out my music. Just search for Matthew Carroll wherever you listen to music.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.